disasters of the apocalypse. Searching for lost tales in eclipse. Why your dreams are shattered lines. Sci-fi whispers lost to time. Welcome, constant listeners from across all the major podcasting platforms. We are the podcasters of the apocalypse, and this is My Internet Has Stopped Working. And today, should I say who I am?
Yes.
And I am Justin the Augmenter Marquis. And I'm going to pass it on to
the Lathe of Harmon.
And I am Claire LaLash LePolwin. Yeah, Fang Tan Twister. You're my name winning.
And based upon those names, you should know that we're now talking about The Lathe of Heaven by Ursula K. Le Guin. I'm going to get us started with First Contact.
If everything's ready here on the dark side of the moon, play the five tones.
When did you first hear of or encounter this work? So here's the book.
So glad we have visual on this.
So I'll talk about it, and then I think we're going to segue into Justin reading the dust jacket. So I encountered this book or the author herself in 2012. I was dating a medical student at the time when I was a grad student at GU before leaving for Peace Corps, and I met this amazing woman who is this man's mother, and she was like, you've got to read this amazing sci-fi author. She's amazing. I read The Dispossessed, which was one of her most famous novels. And after she crossed the Rainbow Bridge after dying from pancreatic cancer, Le Guin herself passed away like a year later. And I got back into reading all of these books. I've got the giant illustrated version of the Earthsea series and stuff like that. So I have kind of had a love affair with her very disturbing and amazing writing for many years now. But I had never read The Lathe of Heaven. So we read The Dust Jackets on like four novels of hers that we hadn't read yet. And this one, everyone was like, yes, we've got to read this one based upon The Dust Jacket.
Dust Jacket time. During a time racked by war and environmental catastrophe, George Orr discovers his dreams alter reality. Fearing his ability, George is compelled to receive treatment from Dr. William Haber, an ambitious sleep psychiatrist who quickly grasps the immense power of George holds. After becoming adept at manipulating George's dreams to reshape the world, Haber seeks the same power for himself. George, with some surprising help, must resist Haber's attempts, which threaten to destroy reality itself. A classic of science fiction, of the science fiction genre, The Lathe of Heaven is prescient in its exploration of the moral risks which overwhelming power is coupled with when overwhelming power is coupled with techno-utopianism. Awesome. Yeah.
Makes you sound like you want to read it.
Did read it. But you want to tell us about your first run-in with Ursula?
Yeah. So I would say I'm fairly new to the fantasy genre, sci-fi genre. So I haven't read a lot of other works, but I have been looking to diversify my current readings. And not surprisingly, but I really enjoyed this novel for a myriad of reasons we'll talk about. But this is my first encounter with Ursula's work, as well as probably in this genre, pretty new to the genre as well.
Excellent.
Nice. What about you?
I have been reading Ursula Le Guin forever. The Earthsea trilogy, now I think at least four or five books, was one of my favorites, probably before I even discovered Tolkien and Frank Herbert.
So good.
So read that, loved it, have my own draft of a novel based on it, but had not read The Lathe of Heaven until we decided to read it. So very excited to dive into it.
We spoke about it and it became an effective dream.
Yeah. Careful.
Plan 9 from Outer Space. Which version or edition are you reading? We read from The Dust Jacket. I actually listened to the audiobook on Audible and it was very good. I thought they did a really good job of voicing all of the different characters, especially some of the alien creatures towards the end. It was pretty funny.
Hello, Lily was speakers.
Good. Yes. And I really liked Heather Lalash's voice, but it was all the same male voice actor who's doing them. So I thought he very talented, very good. Yeah. And then I think everyone else also read
2023 Scribner.
This one with the very attractive cover art there. Mm-hmm.
First of all, it was October, a rare month for boys. Full of cold winds, long nights, dark promises. Days get short, the shadows lengthen. And the wind mourns in such a way you want to run forever through the fields.
So, player attributes, who wrote it and why? Obviously, Le Guin wrote it. She is a prominent American author of sci-fi, fiction, and fantasy. She was influenced by her anthropologist parents and her exposure to Norse and Native American legends, her love of Taoism, and Jungian psychoanalysis. So she's known for her imaginative world building, like in the Earthsea series and in Hainish, which is another series of hers. She has an education in romance languages and deep, rich prose. So her literary background, her exposure to her the linguistics and things like that. She moved to Portland as an adult, which is very apparent that she lives in Oregon.
She was a stoner.
Entirely. That's plausible. So she wrote some of her most famous works there. And The Lathe of Heaven has a ton of Oregon Easter eggs all over it. It's set in Oregon.
Not even Easter eggs. It's just.
It is Oregon. Setting. Yeah.
Honestly, one of my favorite parts about reading it was just having, you know, being that we are here in the Pacific Northwest, having that context of being able to really place this location and the areas that
I could smell it while I was reading.
I thought it was really fun.
Yeah, so she's won numerous awards, 5 Hugo Awards, 5 Nebula Awards, and she's praised for challenging traditional genre boundaries. So a lot of people get really up and I'm like, it's not sci-fi, it's fantasy, blah, blah. Well, she really pushes the bounds of those genres a great deal. And that's why she's so famous. She just, her work speaks to a lot of different people and she explores themes of identity, society, and nature. She also has been known to forego awards in order to allow newer writers in the scene to get recognition for their art and their work. So she's pretty amazing. It's a sad day when she crossed the Rainbow Bridge as well. But she was into Norse mythology, so.
And I was going to say that was the same with Martha Wells that we read just a couple of podcasts ago. Mm-hmm. Also really trying to make way for new authors that are coming up in the genre, which mm-hmm. I think is very cool.
So obviously heavily influenced by philosophy, she was really into particular concepts like balance and effortless action and utilitarianism and determinism. A lot of determinism in this book. So this book was written in the 1970s. So there were temporary concerns related to anti-war, anti-establishment sentimentism, the rise of the hippie movement, and a lot of fear around overpopulation, pollution, and climate change, all very pertinent nowadays. And a lot of early speculation in the medical field around the 70s about government brain manipulation and reality alteration at the time. So she was really talking a lot about really hot button issues at the time. So you guys are welcome to chime in. I felt like the main, you know, Lieutenant Commander Data Analysis, I felt like the main point of the book was to address a lot of issues in the 1970s, anti-war sentiment, overpopulation, environmental issues, and some unsettling wonderings about what the government was doing to people's minds, mind control, and alteration of reality.
Great. Yeah, it's 71, so coming out of the 60s and the CIA. And,
right.
And men who stare at goats stuff.
Yeah, I don't blame them for their anxiety.
Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Heroes and villains.
This is a tough one. Full disclosure, this is the second time we've recorded this podcast. We had an apocalyptic loss of sound. So the previous version does exist, but you have to read our lips. So if this analysis comes off as a little, you know, well-organized, despite our usual, you know, we're usually a little bit more chaotic, but it's because we've been here. We've been here before.
We've done.
Dun, dun, dun. We dreamt this before.
It's a deja vu of
yeah.
the podcast.
We initially in our last version of this episode thought George Orr was an anti-hero. Should we just...
Let's start there.
Let's just go straight to the meat of the matter here. George Orr, anti-hero. We thought, but...
But I posited during the last recording of this that there is literally only one character in this book. And there is only one character of consequence that is almost for sure. So for those who have not read the book, the idea is that this dude, George, literally controls and alters reality through his dreams. Mm-hmm. One man. He is effectively God. He has a dream, and the entire world, all of history before this point in time, changes to match what he wants to have happened in his dream. So, yes, there's Dr. Haber, who is the main psychiatrist who tries to cure George of his lucid dreaming. But he's not introduced until after George's first or second lucid dream. So we have no way of knowing if Dr. Haber exists or existed, or if he was called into being to help George solve his problem. You, of course, got Heather Lalalapulawanach, Heather Lish, who is George's significant other. And then literally everybody else in the book, including Heather, honestly, changes or disappears at the whim of a dream. So I really think, do we call George an anti-hero? Do we just call him God? Is this category irrelevant for this book?
Well, and part of me, as we're getting back into this, makes me wonder, like, why did he dream up Dr. Haber? Like, did he realize that this dreaming was going, like, did he actively want to cure himself of this affliction, we're going to call it?
He calls it that, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or, like, was there a point where the dream now has gotten to a point where he realizes, like, oh, I need to stop doing this because of the effects that I'm starting to see generally populate in the world that I inhabit?
It's incredibly complex and the view that it presents of reality in the world. Like, I forget what page it was. I got to a certain page in the book and I stopped and I went on this whole internal diatribe about God, the way God is manifest in the world. Mm-hmm. This was my senior religion thesis. So I was like, turned on. There is a supplemental podcast recorded by AI that I will attach to this podcast about my musings about God and God incarnate in the world. But if you think about what this means, if this entire reality is controlled by one man, like, what does that say about theology? What does it say about reality? What does it say about the consequentiality of individual humans' lives? Because they are all completely inconsequential. They cease to exist in a moment, or some of them are sprung into existence like the aliens in a moment of dreams. So just...
Or what does it say about free will, right? Like, I'm, like, taking this thread and kind of pulling it out. But, like, Lalanche is only created as his significant other because maybe he decides that he needs a mate. Do you know what I mean? Like, so, like, what does that say about?
She's his dream girl.
Yeah.
Literally.
You know, the implications around free will as well. I think it's interesting.
I think with this interpretation that we came to in our previous recording, I think it really shows the multifaceted, complicated, and fractured nature of human desire. And I think Haber is the dark side, quote unquote, of George's desires. So George
alter
is
alter ego.
Yes. So he is a
Sasha Fierce.
He is Sasha Fierce. He comes off as neutral, kind, a victim. You know.
Oh, George.
Yes, George.
George, yeah.
Neutral,
yeah.
Kind, you know. Demure, you know, passive, all of these adjectives, right? But he also has very vivid, exploratory, intense dreams. Now, are these facilitated by Haber, or is this just a facet of his personality that doesn't come out? And he's the one who really has strong beliefs about overpopulation, about anti-war sentiment about environmentalism, things like that, protect the earth, and, you know, who cares how many people you wipe out, is it, as long as it's not me or my loved ones. And only when that piece of his personality gets too big and too overwhelming does he, you know, essentially negate that piece of the personality, because it's achieved its function.
Right.
You know, the world looks the way that George actually wants it to. He can come back around and meet his dream person, and Haber's in a mental institution, and George is thriving in a world that has less people, less environmental blight, mm-hmm. and a sunny, rosy sunset to go off into the distance.
And fun aliens to talk to.
Right? Yes. So,
yeah, and,
disturbing.
You know, you think about that. We meet him after his... not his first dream, but the first dream that he realizes is effective when he kills his aunt retroactively. Mm-hmm. How many other dreams did he have before that? Like, we don't know where we
are
jumped
in the time.
Into George's world. Like,
yeah.
He could have, who knows, maybe he dreamed that it's overpopulated and overcrowded. Like,
right. He could have created that issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We don't know, because you would assume he's older. He's like 30.
He gave mid-30 vibes.
Yeah, mid-30s. He's been lucid dreaming for 20 years, probably.
He's been lucid dreaming since his early teens,
yeah.
He says in the book. Yeah. And he was being sexually abused by his aunt.
But is that even real? Because that's what I'm wondering. Yeah. It's like, did you just dream one day that you didn't like your aunt and your brain created this new reality? Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I feel like you can take this thread as far as you want.
Yeah, you kind of distrust the whole narrative when you go back and look at it this way. And when you realize all of this, all of what we are seeing could be his dreaming. Mm-hmm. So even from the beginning,
every aspect,
you are now distrusting the entire narrative. Oh my gosh.
And it's crazy, because I do think upon first read, that wasn't the initial impression I got.
Yeah.
I read it as factually
Haber's
in the story.
Yeah,
this
is the bad
happening.
Guy.
Yeah. So I really think it takes a second to kind of like unpack
mm-hmm.
the actual device that's here. It's like, okay, if we took this back, what could that alternate reality look like?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That was, makes it an interesting read and a complex book to understand.
Worth a read, too. It's not a very long one.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, well, I told the captain I'd have this analysis done in an hour.
How long would it really take? An hour? Oh, you didn't tell him how long it would really take, did you?
Well, of course I did.
Oh, laddie, you've got a lot to learn if you want people to think of you as a miracle worker.
Do we want to transition into some science?
Yeah, there's some real science happening in here. So I am one of those people Britt mentioned at the beginning. This isn't science fiction. This is fantasy, maybe horror, honestly. It definitely bridges. And I actually shelved it on my bookshelf at home in my library. As the bridge between science fiction and fantasy.
Oh, really?
It's sitting right there. Le Guin is a perfect bridge between books on Star Trek and fantasy, and the other Le Guin books, actually, that are on the shelf. So this is about technology that Haber, well, let's go back to the actual premise of the book, not our interpretation of it. Technology that Haber, who's the psychologist, uses to control George's dreams. He records his brain waves, amplifies them, replays them back to put him into this lucid dreaming state. His goal is to replicate that state so he can have lucid dreams and control reality himself. So that's that technology. And this stuff is sort of fledgling real, which I think is kind of cool. So we do have something now called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is a non-invasive way of using magnetic fields to simulate the brain that is often used for treating depression, and it's been effective. There's deep brain stimulation, which if anybody watches a show on TLC, maybe called Bailin' Out Loud, about a young lady with Tourette's, this is one of the potential solutions for curing her Tourette's.
Mm-hmm.
It will drill into your brain, implant electrodes in a certain area, to control the action in your brain. So that's a real thing we can do. There's also brain-computer interfaces. Our least favorite tech billionaire is experimenting with implanting things in people's brains so they can control things like robotic arms and mm-hmm. other things of that nature. But there is also a whole scientific field of targeted dream work happening now. So you have something called targeted dream incubation, which uses sensory cues like smell and sound during sleep onset to guide people towards specific dream themes. There's a thing called influencing dream movement that if you do a non-invasive brain stimulation, this again, transcranial direct stimulation over the sensory motor cortex during REM sleep, you can modulate dream content. There's a way of inducing lucid dreams. So research indicates that transcranial alternating current stimulation at a certain frequency over the frontal and temporal regions during REM sleep can increase the likelihood of lucid dreams. And then there's also two-way communication with lucid dreamers. So scientists have established real-time communication with lucid dreamers, enabling them to give instructions and receive responses within the dream. So we are pretty close to that area of things. This is really experimental,
yeah,
new stuff. We obviously most people are not controlling reality with their dreams, so
not yet.
The level of danger to the entire world is probably less, but there's probably some significant risk to individuals. We don't know what the actual effects of dreams are, so it's interesting. Also, one of the things that the government does in this book is map people's brains. They do brain mapping, so they know what everybody's brain looks like and how it works. I think we're right there as well. We're doing a lot of technological research on that also.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some real science in here. Once I started to dig into it, I was like, okay, there is some actual stuff at play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's sciencey stuff.
I didn't have anything else. I think what popped into my head was there's a lot of therapy nowadays with musculoskeletal electrostimulation and things like that for pain management and things like that. So, I mean, it's kind of everywhere,
yeah,
but was not really existing in the, you know, not something you'd go into your primary care doctor and start like talking about these options back in 1971. So I feel like she was definitely ahead of her time with foreseeing, you know, where medical technology, where government intelligence and technology was going. And she's just freaking genius, that's all.
No, we do have some other scientific insight post her writing this book, which might inform our reading of it. So that's string theory, mm-hmm, multiple universe theory. So effectively the idea is every time a decision point is reached, the universe branches. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's what George is doing. He's causing branches of choice. Yeah. So maybe each of his lucid dreams causes a branch in reality and he ends up on the one branch, but there's still the other branch going.
Too many branches.
Yeah. I was thinking like it's not necessarily a technological, science-y kind of thing, but kind of on a similar vein, how many different types of therapies exist where it's like varying levels of consciousness that you're, mm-hmm, at? Like think about those people who are going to Mexico and doing like an ayahuasca trip, right? Like half of this is like, how coherent are you at the same time that you're receiving, right, you know, support or care for a current affliction or something that you're working through?
Or trauma.
Yeah. And so I really feel like this book is kind of like on the precipice of this becoming a lot more mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So maybe not as like a technical advancement, but definitely right. I feel like that similar
chemical
kind of running through
definitely.
It.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pharmaceutical.
Mm-hmm. And no doubt she really is doing an excellent job of predicting where the future will be. The
yeah.
climate disaster, overcrowding, all of those pieces are spot on in terms
yeah.
of what science fiction often does is predict where the future is going to be. Mm-hmm. And this is 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is Adelina Mabel Warren Hagstrom.
Well, if you're going to make a wish, wish for some damn money, will you?
Yeah. So let's transition into word processor of the gods. Mm-hmm. So identify some dramatic or well-written passages. I would put a firm vote in the whole book.
It is incredibly well written.
I have a specific yeah. quote that I'll talk about in a little bit, but the whole book is so well written. And the post-dream components, the way she's able to write you know, the shock, the awe, the wonder, the confusion, just the mix of emotions when, you know, George realizes.
When he's remembering different things at the same time.
Right. It's, and that is a really challenging thing to convey. And the way she does it, you are in there. You feel those emotions. It's just amazing.
The first quote, I pulled out a couple quotes, but the first one, I think we might have talked about this in the first version of this, but the quote that I pulled was, "A machine is more blameless, more sinless than any animal. It has no intentions whatsoever than our own." Kind of thinking that as like the microcosm of the society we live in. You know, society isn't raised necessarily with specific intentions unless we give it to our collective. And so just kind of thinking about how a lot of the different things that occur in this book are products of a system, I think, that's been created in many senses.
Yeah. The intentions in this case for a machine would be the code that we put in it, the bias we build into the machine itself, the data that is being put into that AI.
The training data?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
If I may, I have page 171.
Yeah, don't lose mine. 180.
180. So mine is in reference to Haber's dream. Not a highlighted. I guess I did. She had looked only at him while they ran, and since they had gotten onto the car. The funicular was crossing the river now, high above the water. But there was no water. The river had run dry. The bed of it lay cracked and oozing in the light of the bridges, foul, full of grease and bones and lost tools and dying fish. The great ships lay careened and ruined by the towering, slimy docks. The buildings of downtown Portland, the capital of the world, the high, new, handsome cubes of stone and glass interspersed with measured doses of green, the fortresses of government, research and development, communications, industry, economic planning, environmental control were melting. They were getting soggy and shaky like jello left out in the sun. The corners had already run down the sides, leaving great creamy smears. This is Haber's insanity dream. It's literally melting the world as they run through it, trying to escape.
Ugh. And
so terrifying.
My favorite quote comes after Haber is visited by George and Heather Lalash in... He's been institutionalized. There is a bird in a poem by T.S. Eliot who says that mankind cannot bear very much reality, but the bird is mistaken. A man can endure the entire weight of the universe for 80 years. It is unreality that he cannot bear. Ooh, that quote is, you know, true in the context of this book. You know, it's the ever fracturing, you know, realities that starts to break people, you know, and your inability to carry all of those simultaneous existences in your mind.
Yeah. And I don't know if we can capture that for the audience, worth the read, where every time reality changes, the person in the room, whether that's George or Dr. Haber or Heather, knows both realities. And they spend a lot of time, even in this short book, trying to reconcile where they are now with what they know reality was. And she does a really good job of capturing that.
Yeah, because you have all of your history that you know and the present that was, and then it's changed and you have a new history.
And the old history.
And the old history. And this happened so many times. Mm-hmm. And then you're wondering, well, who am I? What am I?
And which version is the real version?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is the real me? Am I the gray me? Am I the...
No, I was thinking about Heather specifically, like her having to grapple with the two histories of herself, being like, wait, I remember that... I can't remember the specific plot point at this moment, but like, I remember that this was the truth of what had happened.
Being biracial is central to her identity, and it's taken away from her.
I do remember that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's actually a really unique point in this book. The issue of race was addressed by Haber. He's like, let's live in a world where there is no race war. There's no conflict based upon ethnicity or skin color, nothing like that. And, you know, they wake up in this new world and everyone is gray, you know, gradations of black and white. It's, you know, and as a result, Heather Lalash, who is biracial, the foundations of her existence is you know, having a complex, you know, ethnic background. And so she is thus wiped out of existence. So the
her identity,
she's gone. So the only people that were in this future, this existence, this, you know, this new string, were the people who were just one race.
Yeah.
And so they just turned a gray. They just turned gray. So weird. But then in the final reality, there are still gray people in that reality. Yes. So that part, I've never wrapped my head around. I'm like, so people went back to their races, theoretically, because Heather comes back and
what
she's a biracial
babies
woman.
That were born during that period of history.
Yeah.
But there's some gray people and there's aliens. It's like the final scene is the mishmash of goulash that is all the strings coming together in this messy knot. And they're like, well, we got some gray people. We've got some black people, white people.
George threw 20 different realities in a bowl, tossed them up.
And we're hanging out with turtle aliens.
Yeah, like the final scene would be like a group of people and there would be aliens and gray people and black and white people and George and, you know, just all of these different
like
versions. Yeah, all these different versions of the world that we've gone through.
We got some Trekkies. We got some Star Wars fans over here, the HPB people. It's just like, oh my gosh. It was kind of a mishmash at the end of chaos. It was chaotic.
It was chaos.
Ugh.
Power yields chaos, which we're living.
Right.
We walked through the night and made it back to Castle Rock a little past 5 o'clock on Sunday morning, the day before Labor Day. We'd only been gone 2 days, but somehow the town seemed different, smaller.
Did anyone have any additional fan humanoid moments? So identify your favorite moment in the book and why it resonated.
My moment was when I figured out George was God.
Yeah, it's hard to beat that, I think.
Yeah,
that's kind of like light bulb.
I was literally sitting on my back deck reading, and I was like, wait, stop everything. The dude is God.
A dude being God? No.
Although God is a dude.
As long as it's Buddy Jesus, I'm down. Okay.
My favorite scene is actually one of the final scenes in the book where Orr sees his wife or sees the Lanch again, but in like a different reality. And she knows that she knows
he works at the alien record store.
Yes. Honestly. Timeless, great ending. She knows that she knows him, but she doesn't make the connection that they were connected at one point. And so I just thought it was like this kind of beautiful circle moment that comes at the end when they're able to find each other again.
I think what's interesting about that scene is it kind of argues for there being a true narrative, string.
Yeah.
Because it's like a riverbed, you know, you divert it, but it always eventually flows back into its original, you know, its original bed. Yeah. So they theoretically, you know, I don't know a lot about geology, so forgive me for any people who study rivers as a profession, but, you know, they meet again. They've had these many lives since then. She's been grayed out and brought back as she's a narrative ever.
She exists completely.
Yeah.
Right. But they get back into, they're slowly set up to get back into a relationship again. It kind of sets the tone for that. That's how the book ends beyond our reading of it. They get back into that vein and the narrative continues. And it's kind of what was and what will be.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was inevitable. So.
Or love.
Oh.
Even if reality isn't.
Cue romantic sounds.
Oh. We need something uplifting to come out.
I know. But this could all be entirely self-serving if George Orr is this, you know, ultimate fiend who pretends to be this, you know, philanthropic, passive human who doesn't really want to wipe out most of the planet.
Oh, yeah. Well, it makes me also think, like, if Orr was ultimately looking for a companion, he realized he didn't really need help. What he really wanted was acceptance, which I think that Heather gives him, you know, acceptance of who he is. It's a complex. Yeah, complex. But that was definitely, I feel like, one of the uplifting moments of the book where I was like, they found each other.
It was positive.
Mm-hmm.
Master, sir, I heard Yoda talking about midichlorians. I've been wondering, what are midichlorians?
Okay, WTF, what the fiction? So in this phase, we talk about poorly written passages, 404, page not found, passages lost in space, things that are just
too hard to believe.
Mm-hmm. Jump the shark moment. Doesn't make any sense. Anyone? I said I recognize my bias. There are none. Not possible.
There aren't many poorly written passages for sure.
Yeah. I was going to say poorly written. I didn't have anything noted or really even anything cringy.
Nope.
I felt like the writing was
people
you know,
talking from their elbows is
weird. We didn't get sci-fi. To plot twist, which is coming.
Yes.
But yeah, nothing. I feel like the writing honestly is one of the like highest marks of the book is like it's so well written. It's really hard to find fault with a lot of the text itself.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, for anyone who's ever been to Portland, it's not the capital of the world. It'll never be the capital of the world.
No,
it is not the hub of science and industry. Like that for me was like, Portland? Really?
That's funny. But if you were from Portland and you had an effective dream, you would make yourself the center of the universe.
If you could change and alter reality, maybe you would make your hometown the center of the universe.
Portland?
No, I don't think so.
I'm thinking Portland wouldn't be a bad one, but Apple might not be so.
Yeah, not.
Can't. No, the center of the universe can't rhyme with asshole. Okay.
And then a psychologist is effectively the most powerful person in the world. Really? Any doctor, let alone a psychologist, psychiatrist, whatever, is the most important person in the world. And his imagined organization, Hurad, is the governing.
But if you think about it, like what she's arguing is that the mind is the most powerful thing in the universe, right?
Yes.
So anyone who controls the mind has all the power.
But in the world in which we live, that's like, what?
It's fair. It's fair. I'm wondering in my second round of this podcast thinking about this, if you know Haber was too easy to hate, he was so manipulative and so obvious, and you know George Orr, you know, it took him a while to recognize that Haber was complicit and aware. It took him a while. He suspected it, but he didn't confront him. And I don't know. He just, he felt like too easily a villain to me.
Yeah, stereotypical villain.
Yeah. Not going to help anyone who's interested in seeking help from a psychologist. If you're worried about doing that in the first place, I wouldn't encourage you to read this book. It's going to freak you out even more. Okay.
Don't you understand? He won't just influence us. He'll devour us and the rest of the human race if he can.
You're so beautiful.
Please, Crawford.
It won't hurt. I promise.
Lovecraft. Cringy passages. Things that would no longer be acceptable. Asexual reproduction, awkward, racy parts of the book.
There's one there.
Nothing. This is a very platonic relationship, Heather and George.
Yeah. G-rated.
Oh, yeah. Hand-holding was like the X factor in here.
Honestly, I'd be like looking in each other's eyes. I feel like they never really got to the like love or like dating part of their relationship.
There should be a sequel about the aliens having sex.
The turtle elbow tucker, guys. That might be.
I'll leave that one to you.
That might exist in some really deep, dark parts of the internet that I've choose not to venture into. No, thank you. That's not my jam. But to each their own.
It would be cringy.
It's a free country for now. Okay. Yeah. Not much to cringe about. It was almost their relationship was almost so asexual in middle school-y that I found it slightly cringy. I'm like, what is this? You don't know what it is. Are they into each other? Are they just really, really good friends? Like those friends that everybody has that everyone thinks they might be in a relationship, but you're not sure. And they're like, no, we're just besties.
And if we're going back to that, George made her, right? Mm-hmm. Or like me, like, he probably didn't know how to create a woman.
Or he's never had a real intimate relationship.
Yeah, and that's why she's so surface, I think, maybe, in a couple of respects. Like, I think we could have dug more into her character, but we really don't get to as the as the audience.
Because if you think about some sort of like, you know, has real emotional, maybe sexual fantasy relationships with women online, that kind of a guy.
That's the vibe.
Creating a relationship in a reality, he wouldn't really manifest the full spectrum of a real, complicated,
nuanced relationship
when it's you're imagining.
I'm now imagining Kelly LeBrock from Weird Science.
I can see that.
These kids just make what they think is the ideal.
Yeah. That's kind of like the impression I feel like we get. Like he, you know, needs someone that's going to come in and help stop the action that's happening. So he's kind of creating this ideal person that he might imagine.
Like the robot in our first book.
First book? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Do androids dream of like
a droid?
The pleasure bot.
I don't mean that you're not a pleasure bot, Heather LaLash, but you might have become.
I didn't know who she was talking to for a second.
I'm talking to Heather LaLash, okay?
Keep that in.
I don't know if you guys have noticed, but I'm very nerdy.
Which one of us is the pleasure bot?
When I read a book enough and get into it enough, I start to like address the characters. I'm like, I'm sorry, Jane Eyre, but blah, 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 blah. My husband has stopped being startled by these moments. Because I do it too often.
It's funny.
Yes. I'm weird.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger. No, Will Robinson. Danger.
Endgame.
You're on Intruder Alert, right?
Yes. Yeah. In the Endgame, we have our first segment, Intruder Alert, strange and crazy plot twists, jump the shark moments.
Mm-hmm. What I wrote was a crazy jump the shark moment was when the augmenter was speeding up the timelines for the dreams so that they're living in them in real time.
Oh, yeah.
So they'll like start dreaming, but the timelines will start to speed up to the point where they're dreaming like and walking and existing in that space in real time.
Really fast.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Within like 2 or 3 pages, I want to say, you see these timelines start to catch up to each other. And as a reader, you're just like the speed in which they're like going through that threshold was so wild
around them as they walk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mine was, I already revealed when I figure out that a single man is controlling all of reality forever, even before he was born, I assume.
Yes. Altering history, altering the universe historically.
That was
at the molecular level.
That becomes beyond science fiction for me. That was that moment where I was like, this is fantasy or this is horror. Not sci-fi.
So you think he was doing it before he was born? Changing reality?
He had to.
Like in utero?
Yeah, like
no, I
like
think induced? He was doing it. I think when he has a dream now, if he dreamed the world didn't exist,
yeah,
the world would have never existed.
I believe that.
Right? He would alter it all the way back to the beginning of time.
But you're not saying that he had this power. This power was bestowed upon him through birth. Like, once he started dreaming.
Yeah, he's retroactively changing everything.
Yeah, but it's not like his mom or whoever.
No, we don't know.
However he was hosted, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, hosted, I guess.
I don't know. We don't get into his, you know.
I mean, technically all babies are kind of hosted. Little.
With such a crazy, I don't even know if I'd call it a gift. It
sounds like puberty.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't know if he came from like human. Like human means in the same way. Like he feels like something that was like put on the earth and
like
just
God.
Like a Greek god.
Like an alien. Like, you know, like.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Q. He's Q.
Oh, Q is a contentious Star Trek character. Star Wars, haha. Star Trek character. Yes.
Yeah. But there's more than one. They're a whole race.
They are. I like the original Q though. He's just love to hate him. He's so smug. So smug. I was thinking, especially when we started talking about him being born and him being in utero, don't you immediately think of Paul Atreides' sister?
Oh, Aaliyah, yeah.
Yeah?
Wearing my Dune jersey.
See, it all came together.
And in utero, she became aware.
Is stored in the collective unconsciousness.
Yeah, and she became conscious before
of all the Bene Gesserit who had come before her, all her ancestors, as Paul does as well.
But she did it before she
was born.
Was born.
Kind of, yeah, just similar. A few weeks after conception.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, cool.
We watched as the bombs shattered the second comet into a million pieces of ice and rock that burned harmlessly in our atmosphere and lit up the sky for an hour.
So, Deep Impact. This is all you, Justin. Yep. This is the moment where everything that we do is traced back to David Bowie.
Well, that's coming, but there's a lot of cultural impact from the Wynn's work, and this one in particular. It's a tiny novel, but it has influenced a ton of other science fiction work from 71 to now. It moved Taoism into the mainstream of science fiction. That was kind of one of the things it actually accomplished. But then it also talks, anytime this book shows up, when you're talking about mind-bending, alternate reality, science, tech stuff, things like Inception, movies and stories like that. This was serialized in 1971 in Amazing Stories. It won the 1972 Locus Award, finalist for the 71 Nebula and 72 Hugo. Again, Taoism into the popular mainstream. There was a 1980 TV movie, a PBS TV movie, which is moderately entertaining to watch. It was rebroadcast on DVD in 2000. It's still taught in classrooms. It's a go-to text in philosophy courses, literature courses. It talks about utilitarianism, Wu Wei versus technocratic control, post-human subjectivity. It's been a touchstone for social debate about the making of races disappear, like what if colorblind, all of that. What if there was no race? It really ties in with Philip K. Dick's False Realities, key crossroads in the late 60s and early 70s speculative fiction. So it connects to that. It has been adapted for theater. There was a 2012 New York City production, and there is a post-punk rock band named The Lathe of Heaven. Which brings us to David.
Always. There's a starman waiting in the sky.
He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our mind. So we like to connect. I like to connect everything.
You can take credit.
Right, me, Justin, and only. Connects everything to David Bowie. I'm a huge David Bowie fan. So as I was reading this, I was thinking of David Bowie's Quicksand from Hunky Dory, which... Cue the music.
Yes.
Which is basically a song about the inability of humans to deal with their memories and their minds. And that's really what George is. He's incapable of dealing with the power of his own dreams and his mind. And he invents alternate realities to escape from that. The song is about that. So we'll have some of that in there. Overall, there's a lot that Le Guin and Bowie have in common. There's no clear evidence that Bowie read Le Guin, but I assume since he read everything, he read Le Guin. This whole androgyny and gender fluidity and things like the Left Hand of Darkness would resonate with Bowie incredibly. The whole extraterrestrial otherness of a lot of Le Guin's work, that's Bowie to a T, talking about extraterrestrialism. Just this whole science aesthetic, this futuristic thing really parallels between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Pew pews.
Pew pews. We are going to rate this book and our reading of it.
I forgot how I rated it the last time.
I remember how I did, but
I wrote it.
One pew pew is a one. Two pew pews for each level. Sorry, I have a cough.
Two pew noises per level.
Got it.
Yeah. So who wants to go first?
10 noises equates to a perfect rating.
10
which
pew-pews.
Would give 5 pew pews.
5 pew pews. 10 pews.
Yes.
Oh, man, every time.
10 actual noises, 5 collaborative pew pews.
You go first.
Me? I believe I rated this at like a 4.5.
I think that's about right.
Pew pews.
You did.
Loved it.
Pew pew, pew pew, pew pew, pew pew, pew.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 9 noises.
Nicely done. Good
counting. Because I think it was incredibly well written. Anytime a book will stop me in my tracks and make me think, oh my God, this is hard to fathom. Yeah. It changes the entire conception of reality for the reader within the book, outside of the book. It was really cool and powerful for me. Limited, I would love to have more character development.
Yeah.
Yes.
It could have been longer.
I agree. I think it could have been longer. I think that is why I rated mine 3.5 pew pew. So pew 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 pew.
Seven noises.
Yeah. Pew.
Recount.
I'm like, wait, that's right. Yeah. Because I think I agree that it was really well written. I liked the characters and the story that was developing, but I do think it was at times, and I think by design, harder to follow as a reader. And so I think that's the only, not even negative mark, is like sometimes I wish there was a little bit more continuity so I could follow some of the like waves of destruction.
Feature,
but I think it's by design. So maybe it's my personal reading style and what I enjoy reading. But I definitely felt like I enjoyed this book specifically for the writing, the plot, the characters. I thought were all really well developed.
So I'm going to give this 5 pew pews because Ursula K. Le Guin is God.
Oh boy!
And
don't tell George.
Where's your noises?
And oh, pew 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 pew. That's 10 pew
noises.
10 noises. Because all of the discontinuity and the like, when you're taken aback and you're kind of tossed out of reality, it's all planned. It's all purposeful. And her ability to pull you into the narrative and push you out on command, godlike, Ursula.
Fantastic.
The world is
maybe she
an empty place without her in it. But luckily, she left us these amazing texts.
It's a quick read. I would recommend it to anybody who is either a fan of Le Guin, fan of science fiction, fan of fantasy, fan of horror.
Yeah, or philosophy.
Or I think philosophy.
There's a lot of philosophy.
It will give you stuff to think about.
Yeah, it's disturbing. It's thought-provoking. And I think because it balances both sci-fi and fiction and fantasy, all these things, it's, I think, something that a lot of readers would enjoy. It's very accessible.
Yeah.
And it deals with a lot of issues that we all, that are a part of all of our daily lives, but in a way that's super disturbing and creative and highly pertinent nowadays.
Very.
Yes.
So next time, Halloween episode. This is my jam.
We might be dressed up.
I will definitely be dressed up.
We can't decide. That's what you are.
The Breathing Method by Stephen King from the short novella collection Different Seasons, which of course has three stories made into fantastic movies. The Body, which became Stand By Me, Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption, which became Shawshank Redemption, and Apt Pupil, which became the same name. Three fantastic movies, but we are going to read the one story that has not yet been adapted into a movie.
The Breathing Method.
Breathing Method. And it is what it sounds like.
Yeah. When he said, let's read The Breathing Method. I was like, that sounds like a pregnancy therapy. And he goes, yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
I'm waiting for Britt to finish it and slap
me.
Oh, God.
So tune in for our October edition.
Sounds good. We'll see you then.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
In the basement, where the nerds reside, we gather round with a wicked stride. With our books in hand, we start to dive into dystopian worlds that come alive. Yeah.